May it please the court. Corey Riddle with the Public Defender here on behalf of Roston Lee Clark. Mr. Clark was convicted of sexual assault and burglary. Court of Appeals affirmed his conviction, and this court granted certiorari on the issue of whether the Court of Appeals erred in finding that the crime scene DNA evidence without further significant corroborative proof is sufficient to identify Mr. Clark beyond a reasonable doubt as the perpetrator in this case. The crime scene DNA in this case is without further significant corroborative proof. Circumstantial evidence in this case used to convict Mr. Clark does not logically and convincingly lead to the inferences necessary to find this conviction. With that said, I wanted to talk about first the standard of review to evaluate these inferences drawn from the evidence established at court, and second, I want to talk about the facts under this case given the substantial evidence test of Bennett, and then I would like to talk about how this is a DNA-only case. And third, I want to address the Court of Appeals opinion to evaluate not only the DNA-only framework that the Court of Appeals set up based on the fingerprint evidence-only rule, and how I believe that's designed to minimize the possibility of to wrongly convict people with DNA evidence only. And then I want to go on to talk about how I think the Court of Appeals erred in this case when it overleapt its bounds by using facts not established in evidence, shifting the burden of proof to Mr. Clark, and improperly bolstering the evidence used against Mr. Clark. As to the standard of review, in our opening brief, we cited to Leary versus the United States, and the Leary court determined that a statutorily authorized inference must be invalidated unless it can be said with substantial assurance that the presumed fact is more likely than not to flow from the proved fact on which it is made to depend, and it invalidated that statute. In Leary, the court did not get to the question of whether the inferences were good enough to get beyond a reasonable doubt. That was left to a case called Turner versus the United States, where the soundness of inferring criminal guilt by proof of circumstantial facts alone was sufficient for a criminal conviction. And that case was cited by Bicer, which the people in its brief cited, as this court used it in State v. Gonzalez, for the imposition that inferences from established facts are accepted methods of proof when no direct evidence is available. It is essential, however, that there be a logical and convincing connection between the facts established and the conclusion inferred. And the reason I wanted to go over that history just a little bit was to show that this is it's a pretty high standard to get to this logical and convincing. It's beyond preponderance of the evidence. I would suggest that logical and convincing is more than clear and convincing. We have the established facts, and then the inferences drawn from that must be logical and convincing enough for those inferences to be inferred.
Well, as I was reading the briefs, the prosecution argues that you omit a few facts here. And for example, one of them being the extraordinary height of your client, which I don't think is ever mentioned in your brief, that he's apparently a guy of 6'5 or 6'6. And that was a critical factor. So it wasn't all just DNA evidence.
Your Honor, I'm nearly positive, and I can get the brief, but we cited to how tall Mr. Clark was, 6'5". He was 225 pounds, and I'm sure that's in the brief. So it's in the brief. The question.
Why isn't that? You may be in the brief that's mentioned, but you didn't analyze that as a factor in corroborating the DNA.
Well, first of all, the witness said when she was talking to the 911 operator that she assumed the attacker was like 6'2", and I don't know if she mentioned his weight. But then when she was questioned by officers, she also pointed to the alternative suspect and said, he is also, as far as I'm concerned, height and weight might rise. But he was 5'9 and only weighed 150 pounds. So, and I think I did at least talk about that in the brief. I just didn't see this as significant enough.
I guess I'm having trouble with your argument, seeing how this becomes a DNA-only case. Because there's plenty of other evidence, isn't there?
Well, I'd like to go over that evidence and talk about the inferences that are drawn from that evidence. And we talk about, first of all, the state talks about his jacket also, Your Honor. And they said that he had a Carhartt jacket, and they say that she thought it was tan, but she admitted in testimony that she didn't know it was tan. She didn't see the jacket. She said, I inferred it was tan because everybody around here has a tan Carhartt jacket. So that doesn't distinguish Mr. Clark from anybody else who could have been in that area with that particular jacket. And I don't see how his height in that jacket is any more than the scintilla evidence to go along with the DNA evidence. And contrary to what the state claims, there are not other jurisdictions that have found that a description, as well as the DNA evidence, a general description, as well as the DNA evidence, is sufficient to convict anyone beyond a reasonable doubt. For example, we go to State v. Holder, which they cited. That was a robbery case where the police arrived when the robbery was in progress. They chased the robbers the entire time from when they saw them. The robbers started shedding clothes and picked up the clothes along the way. One of the robbers was bitten by a dog. Clothes got all bloody. So they saw the robbers excluding these clothes, and they identified the clothes because they'd seen them on the robbers as well as the victims in that case, followed them the whole time. One of the perpetrators in that case was about 6'6", and the officer had said he was extraordinarily tall. And they used that, but there was also all this other evidence in addition to the DNA evidence, which was that they were seen the whole time by the police as well as the witnesses until they were apprehended and watched them exclude the clothes. If we go to State v. Jackson, which the court also says was just DNA evidence and a general description, it was obtained, and one of the things I want to say about these cases cited by the state is that the DNA evidence from the victims, particularly the rape cases, they were all in places that there is no innocent explanation for the DNA to be there. For example, in the Jackson case, the DNA evidence came from the victim's vaginal swab. And then there was also a description of the victim, but that's a non-innocent place, as opposed to a jacket, like in this case. And in U.S. v. Mason, there was not only the DNA evidence from her panties that matched, but there was also the fact that a glove had been left on the scene that matched a glove that had been assigned to the defendant in that case. This was a military case, so he had particular gloves that he had to wear. So there was more evidence than just the DNA evidence and a general description. In the Mondujano versus State case, there was a vaginal swab and a victim's sweatpants that she was wearing when she was raped. So the DNA evidence isn't just the general description and the DNA evidence being at the location, as in this case. It was in places that you cannot innocently remove, which you could do in this case.
Doesn't your argument depend on us changing our case law that says that circumstantial evidence is of equal weight? Other evidence in any case?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it does. I think the Court of Appeals addressed thoroughly that what they thought as far as the DNA-only case. They used the fingerprint-only case from this court's opinion in Ray, and in Ray, this court cited to Bennett, which talks about the circumstantial-only test, obviously. So I would assume that it was considered by this court when it issued the Ray decision, which the Court of Appeals used to come up with its DNA-only proposition here, that rule. And so I don't think that it excludes the direct and circumstantial evidence should be treated the same.
What your argument?
My argument goes just like the Court of Appeals argument, and that is when we're talking about the substantial evidence, if I look at everything that the state claims were the other circumstances that could lead this court to find sufficient substantial evidence, the state begins by saying, state claims the rapist had to have been in the house before because the victim said the house was hard to find. But none of the officers testified that that house was difficult to find, that any of them had difficulty finding that house. And just because the house was behind the alternative suspect's house doesn't make it hard to find. And I think the court also needs to take into consideration that there was this random stranger wandering around that night. The front door was unlocked. The dogs were barking all this time. I mean, I don't know how the house could have been so hard to find, especially with the fact that none of the officers testified that it was difficult to find. The victim's belief that it was hard to find without any other evidence to support it does not logically and convincingly lead to the inference that the perpetrator in this case must have been to that house before. And the state also claims that the perpetrator felt this need to disguise his voice. But that's just speculation. If she didn't know this perpetrator beforehand, how would she know he was disguising his voice or even attempting to disguise his voice? It just doesn't support it by the record. I don't know how the state can manage to hold on to this. He tried to disguise his voice.
May I interrupt and follow up just a little bit on a thought I had from Justice McCarthy's question about our existing tax dependent test? Mm-hmm. You're not arguing that that's been changed. That's still.
I'm arguing that that still is in existence. And just like with the fingerprint only case, this is.
Let me focus in on one particular part about that test. That is the jury's ability to decide the credibility of witnesses.
Yes.
So for purposes of suspicion, it seems like it has to take the light most favorable to people.
Yes.
Does it seem significant to you in this case that we have, it sounds like evidence that nobody would dispute that the defendant's semen was on the sweatshirt in question, and his account of how it got there is flatly disputed by another witness?
Yes.
If the jury chooses to believe the other witness, is there any explanation? Is there anything? Is it not almost airtight in that case?
Well,
that the defendant deposited his semen in another way, which he's not disclosing?
To begin with, I understand that question, and first of all, I just want to say that whether or not what happened, whether the jury believed Mr. Clark or J.U., the mother in this case, we don't know, because that wasn't a necessary finding.
For the purposes of sufficiency, we have to presume
that they found
favorable to the prosecution?
Well, I don't know if we do, Your Honor, because we don't know. It wasn't a necessary finding. We could just as easily presume. I mean, if we're going to go in the light most favorable to the state, we could presume the jury believed J.U. this didn't happen.
The question for sufficiency is whether it ever should have reached the jury, isn't it? This has been taken away from the jury because there was insufficient evidence for them to be able to find.
It should have been, yes, Your Honor.
So the question is, what's the standard for that? And for purposes of deciding whether we should take the case away from the jury, don't we have to, by our long accepted standards, presume that they drew every inference that was possible in favor of the people's case?
Yes.
Which means here.
So if we, that's, and that's fine. That's fine. Mr. Clark's, but the problem with that is that's only Mr. Clark's. He's surmising about how this might have happened. Whether they believe that's how it happened or not doesn't go to the fact, to the element of the case, is how did he rape her? Did he rape G.O.? Because the question of how I understand the semen was there. And the semen was there, and he can't explain that, but it's not up to him to have to explain this. And I understand the onus of explanation and how that can be on the defendant, to especially in a theft case where there's prior stolen property that the defendant is in possession of, for example. I mean, there is an onus of explanation. Now, then what are you doing in possession of this property if you didn't steal it? It was recently stolen. I understand that, but this is semen that's not exactly where it couldn't be innocently explained. And I understand even in the light most favorable to the state, but the problem we have is that the DNA expert didn't provide us with enough information to presume that this DNA could only have been deposited on that sweatshirt or where it was at when the rape occurred, at the time of the crime. We can't presume that. If the DNA expert had told us that this DNA, this semen, could not have gotten there in any other way, that it couldn't have been there longer than it was, that it only could have been deposited at that time, and that there were no other explanations for this DNA than the three that the Court of Appeals came up with, then we'd have something to work with. But the Court of Appeals made those assumptions as well. When it was reaching this decision, it said, look, there are only three ways this could have happened. Either it was consensual sex, non-consensual sex, or it was on there before the shirt arrived, the sweatshirt. But that was all presumption. The DNA expert didn't testify to anything about that. For her, the DNA could have been there for a long time. She didn't know when it was deposited. She didn't know if Mr. Clark's DNA, as well as the victim's DNA, were deposited at the same time. And I understand that the inferences are all going to the state here in the light most favorable to the state, but there's no evidence to support those inferences. We're making speculative claims, Your Honor, because there's no evidence to support them. And that's the problem with the way the DNA was analyzed in this case.
The jury's entitled to draw logical inferences using their common sense, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. But I don't think that common sense captures the complexity of DNA and sperm analysis. I just don't think we can do that.
Well, my only point is to follow up Justice Malarkey's question is that the circumstantial evidence, the surroundings, there's more involved here than just the DNA. But the DNA is certainly the advance in science that has shown. Definitely gives some more reliability than other cases in which convictions were upheld.
That the semen was in the room. We're not disputing that. We're disputing when that semen got in that room and how it got there. That's the problem. The evidence provided by the DNA expert does not explain that, and it's speculation for anybody else to do that.
All right, so this is solely up to the experts now. The DNA evidence that the experts give are solely determined now, and the quantum of how we're going to decide these cases or let them go to the jury is going to turn on that evidence. And the opinion testimony?
I think in understanding DNA and how it is transferred and maybe deposited, I believe that we need to know more about it than we do. So yes, I think experts are going to come into play, Your Honor, when we're talking about the DNA evidence. It's not as simple as a fingerprint, and it's certainly not as simple as clothing or blood, even, for example. I just think it's more complicated than that, and we don't know based on this record. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Jennifer Berman, registration number 35882, and I represent the people, the respondent in this matter. What I think is interesting about the defendant's arguments is that it sounds a lot like closing argument before the jury. But this panel is not a jury. This panel is not supposed to decide the weight of the evidence. It's not supposed to reconcile conflicting evidence. And it's not supposed to determine the credibility of the witnesses. And that's why the substantial evidence test was put in place, so that this court would merely view the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution to determine if, at a minimum, there was sufficient evidence to lead a reasonable mind to determine that the elements were met beyond a reasonable doubt. And this court can utilize that substantial evidence test here to analyze the DNA evidence and all of the evidence and corroboration demonstrating that the defendant was the perpetrator of the sexual assault.
Counsel, with these new microphones are scary. I was curious about your position at the Court of Appeals adoption of the fingerprint analysis for the DNA. This particular case was inappropriate. Could you talk about that? I know you think it has an undue emphasis on direct as opposed to direct and circumstantial evidence.
Correct.
I know you also feel it shifts this onus of innocence. But if you could just talk about that for a moment, that's what I'm interested in, please.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
My first point on that would be that the test is unnecessary. Again, as I'll go into later, we can analyze the DNA evidence under the substantial evidence test. So creating a whole new test for a subset of evidence where that doesn't exist for any other kind of evidence, except for previously for fingerprint evidence, we just don't need to do that. And the finger...
Why? So if we don't do that, is the fingerprint test then just still sort of standing out there by itself? Do you think it's just an odd result because it was new evidence at the time and that we shouldn't make the same kind of extension, if you will, to DNA?
Absolutely. Yes, you're making good arguments for me. Absolutely. No, thank you. The fingerprint evidence rule was developed before the substantial evidence test came into play. I believe the fingerprint evidence rule started in 1969 in Colorado, whereas the substantial evidence rule, which gave the same weight to circumstantial evidence and direct evidence, came into play in 1973. And so that rule adopted the hypothesis of innocence test, which used to be used for strictly circumstantial evidence, whereby circumstantial evidence had to exclude the any hypothesis other than that of guilt. And the fingerprint evidence rule built upon that. But in 1973, when this court came out with the decision saying, look, circumstantial evidence, direct evidence, we give them the same status. We don't view them differently. Then I think that the fingerprint evidence rule wasn't good law anymore. And it's true that in Ray, they did use the fingerprint evidence rule. Ray came out in 1981 after the Bennett test, Bennett being the substantial evidence test. And I think that Ray is a strange case, to be honest, because it acknowledges the substantial evidence test, and it even acknowledges that that test has deemed hypothesis of innocence, that test, that it deemed it outmoded, that it deemed it confusing and no longer necessary, and yet the case still analyzed the evidence to determine whether the fingerprint evidence plus any corroborating evidence reasonably excluded the hypothesis that the fingerprint was left at a time other than that of the crime. It didn't need to. It could have reviewed the evidence under the substantial evidence test, and it would have come with this court would have come out with the same result, because all you had was one fingerprint on the inside door of a milk chute that was accessible to anybody walking by the victim's home, where the victim's home was burglarized and they thought that the perpetrator entered through the milk chute. That was the only evidence linking the defendant to the crime, and that's a mere modicum of evidence. That would not have survived the substantial evidence test, and it didn't survive the fingerprint evidence rule. But here, the overwhelming evidence here of the defendant's identity survives both tests, and this court can use the substantial evidence test, which it's been using for 37 years, regardless of the kind of case involved or the type of evidence, and it can determine that a reasonable mind would have found beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was the perpetrator. It can first look at the DNA evidence itself. The DNA evidence was found in the victim's bedroom. This is a private area. This is not an area easily accessible to the general public. It was found on...
Now, so before you continue with
yes.
specifically analyzing the particular evidence in the case, I just want to make sure that I'm clear that your prior argument really said two things, and I don't want to kind of reverse them. One is that even if we were so inclined to think that there needs to be sole evidence to test relating to DNA, you're saying this is not an appropriate opportunity for that, and you're about to go into those particulars. But even broader than that, you're saying sole evidence test for DNA or at this point in time for fingerprints or anything else is really unnecessary altogether.
Yes, and I will go into that more. I think it is unnecessary, first of all, because DNA is just like any other evidence. It is not infallible, it has limitations, and those limitations can be explored by the defense at trial. The expert who's presenting the DNA evidence can be cross-examined about the DNA evidence. The defense can present their own experts to impeach the prosecution's expert concerning the evidence. And all of that can be developed before the jury. And therefore, it's a jury question. These are issues that go to the weight of the evidence. This is not an issue that takes it out of the jury's consideration. It's a jury determination. And so we shouldn't have a separate test where really this is the same kind of thing. It's evidence just like any other evidence and should be tested the same way.
I'm sorry, sir. Do you think that's true about fingerprint evidence as well?
I do think that's true about fingerprint evidence.
So we really should overrule Ray?
Go for it. I think you should. I think that the good thing about Ray is it points out that a court may look at the attendant circumstances surrounding the fingerprint. And here, this court may look at the attendant circumstances surrounding the DNA so long as they're in evidence. So you can look at what kind of material was left behind, and is that material susceptible to transfer? Where was the DNA left? What were the premises? What kind of articles was it left on? You can look at all of those things, and from that evidence, you can determine whether a reasonable person would find that the defendant defendant was the person who perpetrated the crime. So you can keep all of those in mind. That stuff is good from Ray. That stuff is good from the Court of Appeals test. But you don't need to apply a different standard for analyzing that evidence. You can do it under the substantial evidence test. In doing so, Justice Martinez, did I answer your question? Okay, thank you.
Why do you think the Ray case even exists? Why? What was unique about that case that created this extra test or this special test for fingerprint evidence?
Well, again, the fingerprint evidence rule was in existence before Ray. It was in existence before the substantial evidence test, back when circumstantial evidence was reviewed under hypothesis of innocence test. Did it exclude every hypothesis other than guilt? But that was applied in Ray, I think, because there really was, it was such an extreme case in that all you had was the fingerprint, and the fingerprint was in this area that anybody, that was completely accessible to anyone, could have been left at any time. And so you did not have substantial evidence proving the defendant's identity as the perpetrator of that burglary. Why they applied the fingerprint evidence rule instead of just going with a substantial evidence test, I don't know. They cited both of them. I don't know why they went one way versus the other when they didn't have to. Yes?
Maybe a little addition, but I was surprised you didn't put in your brief. There's a lot written these days, not so much about the test, but about the unreliability of fingerprint evidence. It's about anywhere it is.
That's a good point. And again, that's something that can be developed at trial. The defense is free to explore that with fingerprint evidence. They're free to explore that with DNA evidence. Again, DNA is not infallible. You know, the defendant argues how susceptible to transfer DNA is. I would argue that's less so the case with semen, which is secreted through the prostate gland. It's not shed the way that hair and skin cells can be. But that's something that could have been developed in front of the jury and therefore presented to the jury as a jury question. They could have reviewed the weight of that evidence against any defense evidence impeaching it. And so both with fingerprint and DNA, there's no reason to, simply because of the type of evidence is, to take it out of consideration of the jury. And here, just to quickly summarize, if we're to review all of the evidence showing that there was substantial evidence of the defendant's identity as the perpetrator, again, we can look at the DNA. Here it was the defendant's semen. As I argue, that's less susceptible to transferability. The semen included both the defendant's sperm and the victim's DNA. The expert testified that that was a mixture, implying that they were mixed together and deposited at the same time. The semen was found on the victim's sweatshirt that she had purchased only 2 days before the sexual assault, and she testified that she washed the sweatshirt before wearing it the day before the sexual assault. Now, granted, there was evidence in cross-examination where she acknowledged that she might not have washed it, but that becomes a jury issue. It's for the jury to reconcile that conflicting evidence. The DNA was also found on a headband, which was the only piece of clothing in the immediate area of the floor where the victim was sexually assaulted. It appeared that all other clothing had been pushed off to the side. And so you see that the DNA, the defendant's semen, was on two articles of clothing that were intimately linked to the sexual assault itself. Furthermore, you can look at the victim's description of the perpetrator. She only saw him for 2 seconds, but she was able to describe his height, his build, his age, and a coat that he was wearing, and those facts generally matched the defendant's characteristics. And again, any discrepancies were present a jury question that would be reviewed by the jury and that this court should review in the light most favorable to the prosecution. Finally, there was evidence that the defendant had an opportunity to commit the crime in that he had been to the victim's home before. And the victim herself testified that her house was hard to find. She said that when she called 911, the paramedics had trouble finding it. Furthermore, the defendant was aware of the victim's son's developmental disability that prevented him from being able to communicate. That's important here because the victim's 4-year-old son was in the room the entire time during the sexual assault. The victim testified that while the perpetrator repeatedly told her to keep quiet, to shut up, he paid no attention to the son. He didn't seem concerned by the son's presence at all. I think that raises a reasonable inference that the person who sexually assaulted the victim knew that the son could not communicate. And with those pieces of evidence all together, a reasonable mind would determine from the evidence that the defendant was the perpetrator, and therefore the case meets the substantial evidence test. If there are no more questions, I would ask that this court affirm the Court of Appeals decision, but review the evidence under the substantial evidence test. Thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. Case will stand submitted. Court is